technology is not the problem. Mobile phones are not the problem. They are tools. It's how we use them that matters. What meditation and mindfulness do is allow you to rethink how you use these devices, because they're extraordinary. We carry supercomputers with us wherever we go. We can do so much with them, but if we're not conscious about how we do it, it can make us miserable.
Pleo is a game changer for business expenses. I've been using them for years because they make expenses easy. I've just set up new cards with limits for my team in just a few clicks. My favorite part is not having to hunt around for loose receipts. I just snap them from my phone and they're automatically categorized and they sync with whatever accounting software you use. More than 5,000 European companies use Pleo, and they're giving you £50 to join me and try them out too. All you need to do is head to www.pleo.io/leaders and book a demo. So go on, head to Pleo today. Before we start today's very special episode on healthy body and mind, I'm proud to say that I've just launched my new company, Heights. Now, after a year of product building, customer trials, and now testimonials from some of the smartest people in the world, including both of today's guests, Stephen Fry, founders of Planet Organic, Huel, and even the UK's most famous man in wellness, Dr. Rangan Chatterjee, who's got the UK's number one podcast and book right now, who not only all start their day with our smart supplement for brain health, but rave about it too. And you can see that on our website homepage. So it would be remiss of me not to share my own delight, and indeed Heights, with listeners of this podcast, as I've been through quite the journey myself throughout it, and if I've learned one thing from our guests, it's to take stock of your own triumphs, and this feels like one today. So to say thanks to listeners, I've created a code for you to try Heights with a 25% discount. You can use HealthyBrain at the checkout on www.yourheights.com. Thanks for indulging me. Now, on to today's episode. Personally, I'm really excited to share today's episode with you. It features two of my favorite, most inspiring people I've met, Michael, the founder of Calm, and Ali, the founder of Babylon. Both are long on vision, great big vision, the kind that people will tell you is ridiculous and fantastical and not to bother with. But that's why they are inspiring and brilliant, because they tell people like that not to reflect their own insecurities on them. They have big dreams and they have the required passion, confidence, and self-belief to get them there. That's why, in this episode, you're going to hear from the founder of the world's largest healthcare app, Babylon, talk to the world's largest mindfulness and meditation app, Calm, about the future of physical and mental health, and who better to share their views on this future than them. I hope you love it as much as I do, so take a deep breath, be calm, and let's begin.
Michael, welcome to the stage. Michael is the founder of MindCandy, Firebox, and Calm.com, which is the world's biggest mindfulness and meditation app, correct?
It is, yes.
So how does someone who was once nicknamed the Willy Wonka of British tech end up creating the world's biggest mindfulness and meditation app? What happened there?
Yeah, goodness, well, I love building businesses. I love taking the crazy ideas bubbling around my head and putting them out there into the marketplace.
And being called Willy Wonka.
And yeah, that was quite fun. And so Moshi was just the most incredible adventure. You know, we had tens of millions of users around the world. We did toys and books and magazines and a movie, and just extraordinary, and grew like this. And we thought it was going to continue forever. You know, we were winning all these awards. We were in the press all the time.
And can you just stop there? Like, take us to your peak. What were your, because I know they're quite staggering, so it's worthwhile sharing. Like, what were your numbers at the time on this journey? Just like to give people a sense of that kind of success and over what period?
Yeah, so about 60,000 signups a day. We had 80 million in total. We had the number one kids DS game, the number one kids magazine. In fact, it was the 24th best-selling magazine in the whole country. We had a movie with Universal. Our music album went to number four on the charts. We sold $1 billion worth of physical product at retail value. So it was quite a ride. And as I say, we just thought it would continue. We thought the graphs would continue going up and to the right, and we'd be the next Disney. And unfortunately, in 2012, that all changed. And it feels like it was almost overnight. Everything was just, we could do no wrong. And then the very next day, it was like we could do no right. Moshi went from being the coolest thing in the playground to not so cool. And numbers just started collapsing. Revenue, DAU, and we just couldn't quite figure it out. And it was very, very scary.
And what did you do? Like, what was your reaction as a founder at the point of, I mean, I'm assuming, you know, everyone had probably been talking about you guys as the next big great thing in Britain, full stop. How, as a founder, did that affect you? What did you do over that subsequent year from this moment?
Yeah, it was terrifying. Lots of sleepless nights, as you can imagine. Super humbling. And then there's just all the practicalities of having to let people go and reduce the team. And that's probably the hardest thing we went through. We had to lay off about 200 people over five different rounds. So you can imagine getting on stage and pouring your heart out and apologizing to the team, but trying to fire up the people who are remaining, having really tough board meetings to try and say how things are going to turn around. So yeah, that whole period was pretty challenging, and it takes a huge toll. You know, a lot of entrepreneurs in this room, you know what it's like. You're so entwined and invested in your business. It is you. And so you feel like you've let down your friends, your family, your employees, your investors, and really, really kind of internalize all that. And so, yeah, wasn't much fun.
And what did you personally do? Did you take a holiday? Did you start drinking? Did you start drinking on a holiday? Did you go with people? Did you go alone? What did you actually find was your reaction?
Well, I just dug in deep and really, really wanted to try and turn it around. So I had a really good, loyal team that we're just trying to crack this. You know, as an entrepreneur, it's a puzzle. How can we turn things around? But as the years kind of ground on, we couldn't. And we just found it so, so difficult. So I think I did, and I mentioned this on the podcast, one of the best things I ever did was step away from the coalface. You know, when you're there and you just can't disconnect from the business, everything is entwined in it. I did something I never had done before, and I highly recommend it, which was to go on a solo holiday and breathe. And
where did you go?
I went to the Alps, to Austria. I love tennis. So I went to this great place where I played tennis in the morning, went for walks, read lots of books, looked into the science of meditation and mindfulness, and started practicing it myself. And it was like this unbelievably bright light bulb went on above my head. And I was like, wow, maybe I don't need to spend the next few years trying to crack this one business. Maybe stepping back and trying something new could be a solution.
And had you ever meditated before at this point?
I didn't, if I'm honest, I didn't really get it. So Alex Chu, my business partner, had been meditating since he was a teenager. He was...
so enlightened.
Yeah, so enlightened in Swindon, or just outside. Incredible.
It's the UK's second most enlightened city, I've heard.
Yeah. Yeah. His first job was stacking shelves in Tesco, and he'd go home and meditate, and, you know, just amazing. So he'd always be kind of very gently nudging me, saying, you know, Michael, try this, try meditation. I'd be like, try fucking off.
Yeah.
That's not for
try
me.
Try buying one of my toys and then there won't be a problem.
Exactly. And the reaction a lot of people have. And I was quite cynical, and there's a lot of baggage with meditation. You know, it's people associate it with religion or hippies or just something that they don't feel is for them. And so I got over that, fortunately. And yeah, when the penny dropped, it dropped in a major way. And I just realized that I love Moshi, I love the entertainment world, but building entertainment businesses is tough, whether it's video games, whether it's movies, whether it's podcasts. Mm. You have to keep coming up with hits.
Thanks for the warning.
So, well, you guys are doing all right.
A bit late.
You've got to keep kind of reinventing yourself and staying one step ahead. Mm. And this is why I love Calm so much, because it feels timeless. You know, this is a fundamental, foundational human emotion that's going to be valuable now, in a year, hopefully in 100 years. And it's the kind of thing we feel we can bet the rest of our careers on.
So before we hand the mic over to Ali, can you give us a rough snapshot of the Calm journey? So you started it in 2012, 2013?
Yeah, we bought the domain name calm.com in 2013 and then launched the app in 2013.
I'm surprised you had any money left in your life after buying calm.com. But...
yeah, it was a little expensive, but we felt it was such a perfect word to build a brand around this.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, Alex moved to California and was there day to day, and I was still working on Mind Candy, but kind of supporting Calm on the side, and we were co-founders. And then I got more and more involved over the last few years, and now we're co-founders and co-CEO. So yeah, just a few numbers. It took quite a while to get to this point. There was a lot of resistance. Spoke to over 100 investors in the early days.
It's been 6 years, right?
Yeah. And fortunately got a few investors that put in 1.5 million for our seed at the very start. And grew to about 8 million downloads without spending a penny on marketing. And then we got another 10 million downloads in 8 months. And we're going to hit the next 10 million in about 4 months. So just the growth is extraordinary. Revenue has been tripling year on year. Forecasting $70-80 million plus this year with a team of 30 people. So it's a really, really staggeringly interesting business, not only from a commercial side, but just as important is the impact it's having on the world and how positive it is.
Yeah, and Apple reports, key success metric is if you can have $1 million revenue per person, you've got two, so you're better than Apple in some in some respects, in some roundabout way of measuring things.
Not quite a $1 trillion.
But you were Apple's App of the Year.
Yes,
well.
So that was an amazing shock. We didn't know that was coming at all. Apple works in very mysterious ways. And we just...
As the old adage goes.
Indeed. And so that was hugely exciting. And
what happens if your App of the Year... Take us through that experience in case anyone this ever happens. But like the global App of the Year for Apple, do they give you a lot of warning? Do they say, charge up your servers? You're about to get a ton more publicity? Or do they just go... Whatever. Like, well, it's just happened.
A few mysterious things were happening. We'd get the odd email from them saying, could you have a look at this artwork, please, and let us know if you approve it. And we're like, okay, fine. Mm-hmm. And then they said, could we have a chat with you on the phone? And we said, okay. So little things like that were going on. We thought it was going to be an editor's choice or something like that. And then one morning, Thursday morning, I was in a coffee shop in town, and a friend said, you should just have a look at the App Store. And that was it. That was the first time we heard it. And straight on the phone to Alex, who was back in San Francisco. And he woke up in the middle of the night and jumping around. And yeah, it's pretty amazing.
What impact does that have numbers-wise to be the App of the Year?
Yeah, so we were getting well over 100,000 downloads a day after that. One of the most interesting things that it did that has sustained, which we didn't expect, was it more than doubled our conversion rate. Mm-hmm. So I think having that badge of being Apple of the Year is such a stamp of authority. So people now using Calm for the freemium then know it's, you know, Apple thumbs up. Mm-hmm. So greatly increased people who then are happy to pay, which obviously has huge knock-on effects for the commercials of the business.
And how are you going to feel when Ali and Babylon Health takes your crown and obviously this year becomes App of the Year and you're yesterday's news?
I would be delighted, and we'd be high-fiving.
Well, on that note, can we bring up to the stage next year's App of the Year winner, Ali Parser from Babylon Health? Ali.
Hi. I think there are more...
Hey, dude. Good to see you.
I think there are more chances of Tunisia winning the game tonight than we becoming App of the Year.
Okay, and just so you know, Ali's got our T-shirt in his pocket. He's not part of a gang that you haven't heard of just yet, in case you're worried.
No, this is my...
So, Ali, your story is slightly different. So, yours actually starts in... Michael, I know yours starts selling rocks to people. Ali's, yours starts as actually an immigrant coming over from Iran, leaving their family behind as a teenager, age 15, is that right?
16.
That's right, yeah. Okay. Take us through that experience, your early years. I mean, what was that like coming over to England? Did you know how to speak English? Did you know people?
So when, I guess I was one of these people when I arrived in England that you would say, how are you? And I would say 10 to 4. I had no understanding of language. And I actually, my only knowledge of English and England was formed by a single guy. His name was Bond, James Bond, and that's all I understood of England. But I got lucky, and look, I think it's Malcolm Gladwell that says, in life you get what he calls desirable difficulties. And that really was a desirable difficulty. The old adage that whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger is very true. And when I look at my life now, those were hard days, but they were the best days that could have happened. Mm-hmm. And I don't know of any other immigrant who had to go through those things that regrets it. Having said that, we are now facing a crisis in Europe where we are having more teenage immigrants committing suicide because of how hard it is than we have in some cities, local people doing it. And when you look at how small those numbers are compared. So it's not easy, but it's fun if you get through it.
Yeah, and as I understand it, you educated yourself, learned how to do your O levels at the time.
Yes.
Good.
You're not betraying my age.
Just a guess. Yeah, it's when my mum corrects me that everything's O levels. I was just making an assumption here as well. But you were learning your O levels at the time, at the same time learning English.
Yes.
Correct?
Yeah.
So how did you do in those exams? Where did you go? And what was your starting point? Because this is, you know, it's okay, very different if you don't have a support network.
But then you make it sound too glamorous, right? So I was 16. I arrived in UK. And when you're 16, going to university, if you do 2 years, 1 year of English, they said I have to learn, then do 2 years of O-levels or GCSEs, and then 2 years of A-levels. And you kind of do the math and you say, okay, I'll be 21 when I get to university. And when you're 16, 21 sounds ancient, right? You think your life is going to go by. So I locked myself in a room and I taught myself English. I bought myself this A-levels, O-levels book. I passed them through. And I got offered Cambridge and UCL. And I was so dumb, if you want, as an outsider, I didn't know Cambridge is a great university. I kind of thought that UCL is in London, big city, Cambridge, tiny little old town. Surely this is better, right? And that is important to me because we now support a lot of people who come from comprehensive schools that don't have that mentorship, right? And when you don't know, we all take it for granted that everybody knows Cambridge, great. I mean, go outside and ask somebody, name me three colleges in Cambridge. And outside your community of middle class kids, who knows three colleges, right? The name of three colleges. So I think there is a lot about blessing not knowing. Having said that, UCL was the greatest place I could be. I mean, I utterly enjoyed it. I spent 10 years of my life at UCL.
Yeah, and you started your first business there, pretty much, correct?
And I started my first business.
And then by, I guess you took a, you started a company, you exited it, and then you moved into Goldman Sachs, like any good entrepreneur, correct?
Yes.
So are you still dusting off the evil? Like, what's happened since then?
So I built a business to pay for my PhD, because, as you know, research doesn't pay. And the bankers who sold it for me, per hour of time they spent on the business, made an astronomically more money than I did in building the thing. And being an outsider, you kind of always see these guys in really nice suits, and you say, well, what if I could wear those suits, right? So I became a banker for a while. Worst thing I ever did, by the way.
I'd just like to say, I don't think Michael's ever looked at a banker and gone, I want to wear that suit.
It's funny you should say that. I actually wanted to be an investment banker. That was my dream as a kid. I'd watched Wall Street and thought it sounded the most glamorous, exciting world ever. But it's not, is it?
It actually is very glamorous. And it's
great,
right?
You didn't do it. I think Ali, okay? He did it.
But I tell you, I didn't like it. I didn't like it partly because I was rubbish at it, right? And I think you need to be... I got promoted all the time because I was an entrepreneur. I got to bank entrepreneurs. They liked me a lot against the usual bankers they were dealing with. So the bank confused the fact that the customers liked me, the clients liked me, with the fact that I knew what I was talking about. And but I got lucky because my first child was born when I was 35, 36, which is pretty late in life to have your first child, in at least at the time I taught. And I had this like, what am I doing what I don't love? So I thought I'm going to become a dad, right? So I quit everything. I had 2 weeks of paternity leave. I went back. I saw the head of the banking team, and I said, I'm done. I want to kind of go. And 6 months of gaga goo-goo later, I decided, okay, I got to go back, become an entrepreneur again. But I decided I want to become an entrepreneur rather than...
And just to make sure we're all passively insulting each other together, like a collective, Michael, when did you just have your first child?
Yes, we had our first child, who's here in the audience, actually.
Yeah, being very, very well-behaved and quiet.
Our 5 months, 5 and a half months ago on Christmas Day.
But you're obviously 35, 36 as well, so...
Around that age.
Yeah, naturally.
That is just,
which, to clarify, is late in your life.
Just about the most brutal, cruel birthday you can give a child, right?
Yes, I mean,
birthday and Christmas Day is the same, right?
No, we're going to have a summer birthday party for it as well. Yeah.
Okay, so... before you founded Babylon Health, you were also building the UK's largest private medical healthcare chain. What was your unique insight there, and what was your experience leaving it, in a nutshell? If you could tell the Circle story in a couple of minutes, because we want to tease people to listen to your actual episode, of course, for the full story.
So I did a knee surgery, a series of knee surgeries. I used to do a lot of sports, and I had a series of problems with my knee. I did a series of knee surgeries in what used to be London's best private hospital. And at best, I would describe it as a 2 to 3 star hotel. And I thought, look, if that's the best £1,000 a night can buy you, surely you could do a lot better than that. And that's at the time. So we thought, why don't we build our own chain of hospitals? I got Lehman Brothers and RBS, two great choices, to back me.
What year was that?
2006. You know, every entrepreneur who tells you they're so brilliant, behind it sits like a lot of like rubbish, right? I mean, I remember...
That's quite unlucky, though.
I know, but I remember them doing all sorts of due diligence on us. It never occurred to me that we should do due diligence on them. But so they're all gone. But it gives you a really good story, right? Because now, when big corporations come to you and say, I have to do due diligence on you to make sure if you survive or not, it is significantly more likely, if you're doing well today, at the start of your journey, that they will be the ones who are in trouble than you are. That's just true. I cannot look at a single customer of ours today where I don't believe that the risk on them not doing well 5 to 10 years from now is significantly more than the risk on us not doing well. So anyways, so we built Circle. With the financial crisis happened, those two companies fell apart. We had to raise, they had committed £500 million of financing to us. We had to now find that money. And we did 11 rounds of financing, raised something like £250 million in the middle of financial crisis, which for those of you who haven't seen me, I used to be 6'4", blue eyes and blonde hair.
You used to look just like Michael.
Exactly.
It would have been uncanny having
this. This is me
together.
Before the financial crisis.
This is actually a before and after.
Like Danny DeVito. When Dan said that the two of us should get together, I said, what, you watch the movie Twin? Like you're getting Michael with the genetic garbage in the same room? So anyway, so, and then we raised the money, da-da-da. The company did well. We made one single mistake, which was we had one wrong investor in the group. We had brilliant investors. We had one VC. Any VC guys here tonight? Good. So
definitely no one brave enough
so
to admit
no
it.
No one brave enough. We had one VC. And not all VCs are the same, but we had one VC in the group. They just panicked, right? The business started doing well. They wanted to cash out because if you're a partner in a small fund, one business doing well, you take the company public, cashing out means a lot. So people talk about investors becoming really bad when things do badly, but investors could also turn on you when things do well. So we had a major difference. We took the company public. And when we took it public, how many of you have watched the movie Steve Jobs, the Apple movie, when they take it public and a bunch of guys with a suit walk in through the door? And they did. And they acted as if this was their company. And I remember this very well. We tripled our revenue every year for 6, 7, 8 years. We took it public. We didn't add a single penny to the revenue. Not one penny. Because everything became, we need to analyze it. We need to do this, da, da, da. And unlike most of you, I'm pretty old. So life was too short. So I sold my stock. I got out. And I wanted to do Babylon inside that business. And they didn't want to do it. They thought it's a lack of focus. And the issue with entrepreneurs are, and I'm sure we talk about this, is when something gets under your skin, you just have to do it, right? That's why we mortgage our houses. That's why we spend 50 hours a week, but that's not a lot of time, is it? So, but that's what we spend 50 to 70 hours a week. And by the way, I don't believe, we can talk about this later, I don't believe in people who say I spend 100 hours a week. I used to work 80, 90 hours a week, 100 hours a week. I tell you, you don't work. You do 40 hours of decent job and 40 hours of being a zombie. and it's just no good for anybody. You need to have a balance between effective work and the amount of work you have to do.
What do D2C brands like Custom Ink, Colourpop, Huckberry, and even my new company, Heights, all have in common? We all use Klaviyo as our growth marketing platform. From a shopper's first impression to each subsequent purchase, Klaviyo understands every interaction, empowering you to create more personalized marketing moments with customers. If you're an online business and want to get a 360 marketing view of your customer, try Klaviyo today.
What stage is Babylon at the moment? I mean, I've seen that you've just closed a couple of big partnerships. You're growing really fast. Don't let me say all of the accolades on your behalf.
Can you lift up the baby one more time? That's the stage we're in. we are at our babyhood. I genuinely think, and I would, wouldn't I, because I'm a believer in my own nonsense, but I genuinely think we have the making of one of the world's largest companies. And whether we can build it or not is entirely up to us. But if you think about healthcare being a $10 trillion industry, and you think that we spend 4 to 5 years figuring out what we do with this, it has taken us a long time to get to here, but now we have all the building blocks. And you know, our revenue, we're just about to announce something. We haven't announced it yet. You're live streaming, so I wouldn't announce it. But some of the stuff we are doing
there
right now.
There are some now, zeros in there.
It's some serious zeros in there. But more importantly, some serious partners. I mean, we announced a partnership with Tencent that hopefully can take us to 1 billion people in China if they implement it through WeChat. We're now in every single Samsung phone in the world, not as an app, but as their operating system behind the Samsung phone, starting with UK, hopefully getting everywhere else. But also, we are, as Babylon, we are your primary care provider, or want to be. But if you are your primary care provider, we are also your gateway to healthcare. And the only reason you get your long-term disease management from somebody else is because your primary care providers all across the world are mom and pop shops, and they don't have the capability to organize everything in one go. Now, whether we can pull it off or not, I don't know, but somebody will pull it off. And when they do, they will create an amazing business.
And let's hope that that is you. Of course.
To humanity, it's irrelevant, right? To humanity, it's irrelevant if it's Babylon that makes healthcare accessible, affordable, and put it in the hands of every human being on Earth, or if it's Johnny Smith or Ahmed Khodai. It's where they come from, which part of the world, which part of the thing is irrelevant. What matters is that this is a problem that can be solved. I do not believe we will have a healthcare accessibility and affordability problem, the healthcare solutions we provide today, in 10 years' time. I think somebody will make healthcare, do with healthcare what Google did with information, make it accessible, affordable for everybody, anywhere they are.
Agreed. And that is the perfect segue into our topic. But if you want to hear more about either of their journeys, then Michael's episode is in series one and Ali's is in series two. Right, so to discuss the future of healthcare and what it kind of means to be healthy, I mean, I think first it might make sense to define what healthy means to each of you. So we have, technically speaking, a specialist of the mind, and technically speaking, a specialist of the body, although I know that's not what your doctorate is necessarily in. But you work with people in these fields every single day. So, Michael, first, what does healthy mean to you?
I would say if I had to pin down four areas, they would be sleep, getting enough sleep, understanding what sleep you need, because each of us needs something slightly different, regular movement, nutrition, and some kind of mindfulness meditation practice. I think those four are the pillars of a healthy life.
And Ali? Football, number five.
I just landed back from Russia, so yes, I am a football fanatic. But the...
Just so everyone knows, it was Ali that picked this date, by the way. So don't feel too bad for him. It was his choice.
No, I feel actually, I'm feeling incredibly privileged that people have come tonight. The the question I got is, to me, what we define as healthcare today, which I get a disease, I'm diagnosed, somebody helps me through my recovery, and sometimes I don't recover and I have a problem for life like diabetes and it needs to be managed, that is not healthcare, right? That's sick care. I got sick, somebody looked after that. If you come to me and say, hey, how do you keep me at the peak of my health? What do? I do a health assessment of you. I give you a plan to stay at the peak of your health. I give you coaches if you're a football pro. And then somebody monitors you. And so, as because they're monitoring you, they can predict your health very closely. We're on the verge of being able to do that, right? So I'm wearing this ring. It monitors my whole bunch of things, by including my heart rate. My normal natural heart rate is about 60 beats per minute. And there are times when it's 67, 65 is when I had a couple of glasses of wine and the body is fighting the toxins over the night. But when it gets to 70, 71 over one, two, three nights, you just know like a clockwork that your body is fighting something and it's going to show yourself, right? It's going to be a cold or something coming out. We can predict more nowadays than one can imagine. I think that we're going to move into an era that we will do quite a lot with healthcare, not just sick care. And a healthy mind is absolutely everything. I mean, I'm amazed how we do not think mental health is part of health, right? We almost give it a separate name, mental health, right? I mean.
So just to ask a prickly question on the basis of what you just said. So
you asking a prickly question?
Yeah, I know.
Who
would
have
thought? Yeah, I know. I was going to reference it to an ex-banker. But, you know, the reality is, and it's been discussed in many other forums, the system is not set up to encourage prevention.
Yes.
The entire system is set up to encourage financial incentives towards healing the sick. So how systemic do you think that problem is, and how do you see us moving away as a society? Because that runs a lot deeper than a few entrepreneurs with a great vision in mind of how to do things. That is a fundamental way that the world exists today.
I think you put your hand into a really right place. Our government, for instance, in Britain, just announced a $20 billion increase to the NHS, right? Where do you guys think that money is going to go? Right. I tell you, 70% of everything we spend in healthcare goes into salaries. I bet that 60 to 70% of this money will go into increasing people's pay. Right. So all this extra money we spend, almost immediately, the moment they're allocated, will be called for and accounted for. There is very little money in the system to do anything new with it, right? It's very, very little. And prevention has very little budget. That's why I'm not a big believer that you could create prevention within the existing system, because the existing system doesn't have ways of paying for prevention. We don't have a healthcare system. We have a sick care system. Mm. And that's our system globally everywhere. So what I like is our deal with the NHS, where we can be your GP, right? So you can switch your GP, as 4% of people in central London already have done, to be Babylon, all paid for by the NHS. But now we need to look after you, hopefully for life, right? Now we have a massive incentive to keep you healthy for a very long period of time. We don't get paid every time you come and see us. We get paid a lump sum to look after you, and that lump sum repeats itself every year. Our interest is to keep you happy so you stay, and our interest is also to keep you healthy so you don't visit your GP too many times, right? So now the incentives are aligned. So I think there is something about the capitated pay. The way the existing system deals with this is by keeping you away from seeing a doctor, by giving you a long waiting time, because most diseases kind of figure themselves out in 2 weeks, the little stuff, right? So that's why magically the waiting time is 2 weeks, right, for most things. But reality is, if you bring the waiting time, as we have done, to a few minutes, then there is really no incentive for you not to constantly book a consultation, unless we figure out better ways for you to get your answer without spending 30 quid to go with a doctor. And considering somebody your age, we get paid only 30, 40, 50 pounds a year for. You use it 3-4 times a year, we're kind of in the red. So now incentives will be aligned, and I think that capitated model works really well. But it's under pressure, right?
Mm. And well, Ali, you actually mentioned yourself how we classify the idea of mental health as a separate thing entirely. But Michael, do you think that that's an important distinction at the moment because it enables us to have an open conversation about a thing rather than hoping and assuming that it's the right way of framing it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, just a few years ago, mental health was very much in the shadows. It wasn't really something you talked about. It's just shocking when you think about it. If you have a body, you have physical health. If you have a mind, you have mental health. And thank God this is now starting to change. And I think it's super exciting. And to the previous question, I think one of the other really exciting things that are happening in the world of the internet and technology is people are taking responsibility for their own health and learning more about it. Now, if you go online and search symptoms or whatever, you'll find all sorts of crazy stuff. But as all this information starts to get organized and presented in better ways, you know, through apps like Aptiv or Calm or others, people now are taking that responsibility. We're still at the early stage, but I think that's hugely exciting for the future of health.
So, Ali, just to take it back to a conversation that we've had in the past, where we were discussing, I think, during the podcast episode, Sapiens.
Yes.
And, you know, the idea of understanding human history as a way, as a predictor, basically, of understanding the future. How important do you think it is understanding the history of the healthcare system and the history of how we as human beings have existed with each other through different healthcare epidemics in terms of understanding what will happen in the next 20, 30 years? I mean, so, do you study history as part of understanding how you as an entrepreneur make that impact in the future?
So I'm not sure if I do it as a part of understanding how I work as an entrepreneur, but I love history. So it's my passion. I spend a lot of time reading historic books, right? And one of the things that is fascinating is actually we haven't made much progress in longevity of human life, right, throughout our history, right? So Galileo lived to his 80s. I mean, the world as Socrates lived pretty long. Like, we've never managed to elongate human life. What we managed to do is stop diseases killing people as prematurely, right? For the first time in history, we are on the verge of being able not to be just recipients of the biology that was handed to us, but be able to have design of that biology, right? We've now created a worm that lives 6 times longer than a normal worm. We've created a rat that is 10 times more intelligent than a normal rat. We've created a tomato that does not age, right? You're on this unbelievable cusp where we are not just who we are, but we have what they call intelligent, or it could be dumb design, right? We call it intelligent design, but it could be completely dumb. And this is an area that whoever tells you what they know what they're getting into is complete nonsense. We have absolutely no idea what the result of this could be. When somebody as intelligent as Stephen Hawking says artificial intelligence could be an existential threat to humanity, it is absolutely true, but so could the way we are manipulating our genes, our DNA, everything else we're playing with. I think people forget the reality of unforeseen consequences. Look, I'm a physicist. In physics, one of the most famous papers in physics you all know about is called, it was by Lorentz, and he said, when a butterfly flaps its wing in Brasilia, there could be a hurricane in Texas. But that's a part of the headline you all remember. The headline had a second half to it, and that was, or it may not. Mm-hmm. And that's just the reality, right? There are so many things that can interact in the way they shape our future that no program, no human being, nobody can predict it. And we are unleashing forces we have absolutely no way to understand how they would unfold. We just hope for the best.
But I mean, okay, so take this, to put it in a different perspective. So if Calm fulfills its mission and we have healthier lives and we're mentally happy and we're stable and we understand who we are as people and we're comfortable and we're not tragically committing suicide in droves like we seem to today in society. And Babylon, at the same time, fulfills its mission and provides accessible and affordable healthcare across the world, not just places like London, but, you know, in wherever, Djibouti, like anywhere in the world, then there's 7.6 billion people on Earth today. And the other conversation that we're not having here is obviously the environmental impact on the growth of society, limited resources, plastics, et cetera, et cetera. Now, have you thought about, to give a bleaker look, if Elon Musk is unable to send us to Mars and Bill Gates is successful in wiping out malaria, how, you know, the extended life of every single citizen here on Earth and you guys being successful in your mission might actually create a bigger problem than you anticipated by overpopulation, which of course is not your burden to bear, but I'm going to put it all on you. Shame on you. Yeah.
I think human beings are an extraordinary species. We've done amazing things. Just look at the progress we've made in the last few decades. And I think we will continue to find very smart, creative solutions to the problems that humanity faces. I think we are given a barrage of negative information through the media about how the world is getting worse and everything is a disaster. That is so not true. There's a brilliant book I'd urge everyone to read called Factfulness, which talks about how across most of the major measures, the world is getting much, much better, but we don't hear about it. You know, infant mortality rate way, way, way down. Life expectancy going up. People around the world in developed nations educated to primary and beyond. Etc., etc., etc. So I think the world can support a bigger population than we have currently. And I think as it grows and we lead more joyful, happy, purposeful, meaning lives, that is only a positive, wonderful thing. And we will find solutions to the many other problems that will face us as the world evolves. So I'm a huge optimist for where things are going. And I think helping physical health and mental health is key to that.
Ali, do you agree there's never been a better time to be alive? And I guess exactly the same as Michael, or have you potentially got a darker perspective?
I couldn't agree with Michael more. I mean, people talk about the world going wrong in really ridiculous ways, right? I mean... There is no wars going on in the world right now. There is small pockets of war, but the world has never been this peaceful. More children stay alive right now than we lost in every year than we lost in the First or the Second World War, right? If you think about it, right? We used to lose more kids to these things than we did before. People forget we lost more people in the World War to malaria than we did to all the atrocities of the war, right? And we don't lose people to these things anymore, not in the droves that we used to. Healthcare is not equally distributed, but it is much better everywhere. We're not just in UK, we are in Rwanda also, right? We serve one-third of the population of Rwanda, 2 million people are registered on Babylon. This is not... The world is a much, much better place, but it creates its own problems. And as Michael said, we need to learn how to deal with this problem. By the way, the population of the world, there is no research that shows the population of the world is going to grow, right? What we know is that as people become wealthier, they have less children. Actually, King Edward, for instance, speaking of history, had 16 children. How many of them lived? Two. Past the age of 20. That's why he had to have 16, right? To make sure two lives. You look at Korea, it used to be average family, used to be eight, now is three, right? As it became richer over time. So I think most models show the population of the world will settle somewhere between 8 to 11 billion as it becomes richer. Now we cannot predict these things, but also look, we feed more people per square foot. Imagine if we could feed people the way the Dutch feed their people, right? How many people can we support, right? And not, it's a matter of accident in history that we are burning fossil fuel. It's the most stupid thing we're doing. But it's because it's so cheap, we do a lot of it. But again, that's just a 100-year blip, right? All this plastic we are creating and burning is a 50-year blip. Our planet has the ability to clean itself. Do you remember, I mean, again, history, London, you couldn't see yourself 20 meters forward, look at it. Like I saw the other day somebody fishing in the Thames, right? I mean, this is one of the most polluted waters in the world. I just came from Russia, where in St. Petersburg, I saw people fishing in the river, right? Again, only 5 years ago, that river was dead, right? Our planet has a way of regenerating. Humans have a way of regenerating ourselves. I'm an optimist.
Yeah, and let's help those people, the 7.5 billion people on this planet, to live amazing lives. It's extraordinary when you think about it. You touched on it earlier. The number of deaths to suicide, it's one mm-hmm. of the biggest killers of men of a certain age. 43,000 deaths to suicide in America alone every year. Mind-blowing. $3 trillion is spent on healthcare in the US, but a tiny fraction of that is on mental health. So I think this is one of the biggest areas that we need to be devoting time and energy and research to.
And have you both looked into coming into prevention, not cures? The effect of nutrition, for example. I mean, I almost feel like we should have a third seat, which is a nutritionist here, to discuss how, you know, it's what you put into your body, really, that makes the most impact and the biggest difference. Assuming that I'm taking that spot, I'm the nutritionist, and I've just said that from some sort of formal authority. Would you agree with it? Would you disagree with it? And have you had those kind of debates in your fields?
So look, the factors that affect your life is, and you get people who become really, really ideological about these things, right? But the truth is this. It's neither of those things, but it's all of those things. Your genetics has a huge effect on your life. For instance, on mental health, there's a lot of research that shows you're almost born with the happiness that you're born with. Now, it's like a thermostat that is set. You can bring it up at 2 degrees or down 2 degrees, but you are who you are. And as a father of 3 children, I can tell you, my most miserable child has always been miserable. My happiest child has always been happy, right? And shit, this is being live streamed. I'm talking hypothetically.
Yeah, metaphorical but, children.
Yes, metaphorical children. Yeah. But that's just the reality. So it's your genetics. It's your biology. It's your food that you eat. It's the activities and the behaviors you do. Is the environment in which you're in, right? And each of those, your genetics and your biology are its own, it's a mystery to us. We know nothing about the brain, right? Everybody who has a problem, we call it personality, borderline personality disorder. I mean, everybody, come on, this must be, you remember the days that cancer used to be called one disease, cancer? Like, we know nothing about mental health diseases and mental illnesses. Michael says 45,000 people lose their lives in the United States. 2 years ago was the first year in human history, I think, where we lost more people to suicide than we lost to war, to crime, and to terrorism put together. Mm. How much money goes into defense, terrorism, and crime, how much money goes into mental health?
Hey guys, I want to tell you about our awesome long-standing recruitment partner and where I go to hire top talent every time, LaFosse Associates. They're not only the recruitment partner of choice for your host, but many of our guests too. So check out www.lafosse.com the next time you're looking for a brilliant hire.
I actually heard an event the other day, someone talking about how the 1800s were all about, you know, the biggest epidemic was essentially war and people fighting, and that was the biggest loss of life and that sort of period. And then it became diseases, right? It was all cancers and AIDS and everything else that could affect your body. And now it's quite clearly like your own mind.
Yeah, yes.
That is actually the biggest epidemic.
Our own minds
epidemic.
Are turning on us. Our minds are so on fire in Western societies that it's literally killing ourselves. And it's not just the extreme of suicide, but it's depression and anxiety and all these other mental health issues. Another similar stat to that was shocking. A few years ago was the first year in human history where more people died from overeating than lack of food.
Yes.
I mean, isn't that extraordinary that we are feeding ourselves to death? Again, our brain's just not able to find the off switch. And what the hell is going on? This is crazy.
And obviously, you live in mostly in San Francisco now, right? Mm. So how, you spend like a lot of time here, a lot of time there.
Yeah.
How do you find the two behaviors? What's the, I mean, again, San Francisco is a bit of a pocket of America, so it's maybe difficult to get the full view, but how do you view the different attitudes towards those problems in America versus in England?
Yeah, I love both cities, amazing places to live and build businesses. San Francisco is very, very tech-centric, but very open-minded as well, in a way that England can sometimes be a little bit cynical. So one of the reasons we wanted to base Calm there was because of the awareness, the consciousness around mindfulness and mental health and meditation and leaning into that. You know, one of the things that is a hot topic of conversation over there is around using psychedelic drugs to help with mental health. Mm. And this often takes a big intake of breath, because society has demonized these drugs since the 60s and the Nixon war on drugs and LSD and everything else is so dangerous. But we're starting to see this extraordinary movement, how these compounds could teach us more about the brain than anything else that we have done before, how they could potentially rewire brains that are calcified around certain behaviors, the ruminations around anxiety and depression and so forth, how taking these compounds can, almost like a snow globe, shake up the brain or reset or refrag a computer. One of the great examples was a ski slope, and how people with these mental health disorders, there were these well-grooved lines that the skiers go down again and again and again, and they can't get out of those loops. Taking these compounds in a clinical setting, under the right guidance, can shake up and reconnect the brain in different ways, almost like a fresh snowfall, so they then have the chance to ski down and make new paths down the mountain. So fascinating. There's a great book by Michael Pollan called How to Change Your Mind, which again, I'd highly recommend. And I think early days, but hugely exciting research going on there.
I mean, just on that, you know, it's interesting how medicine and legislation are so at odds with each other often. Obviously, in Britain, we had the famous David Nutt experiment where you know, he was literally commissioned to research the impact of illegal drugs and basically came out in favor of all of it, so then they just fired him and decommissioned the whole thing. So that's not the answer we were looking for, mate, see you later, which is absurd. Interestingly, as I understand it, this isn't necessarily on the mental health but on the physical health more, but medical marijuana, which, you know, has just been legalized in California. It's legal in Washington, I believe. And it's
legal in 20 countries, I think, around the world.
In America, that seems to be a growing trend as well, right? By state. But then obviously you have some very polarized states there. And I went to a fascinating conversation on medical marijuana, and they were testing it in, I can't remember the name of the state, but it was one of the most Christian states, where it's basically the devil's work, as in you're absolutely like a hardcore drug addict, the devil, if you do it. And they had to convince this family to let their child, who had multiple sclerosis, try medical marijuana as part of the process. And they accepted very begrudgingly and reluctantly, and they've had like phenomenal results. And now they're creating like a whole strain of medical marijuana to treat that type of multiple sclerosis, based off this instance where it's a really great example that's obviously not a recreational state, right? Mm-hmm. They all hate the idea of drugs. It's a very Christian state, but in a medicinal setting, it's very important. So it's quite interesting how consciousness is sort of slowly getting out of that post-Nixon behavioral attitude.
And shocking to think, you know, the number of people that die from alcohol and the impact that has on lives, and tobacco, just on a completely different scale to these other compounds. Again, it's one of these examples where society can get something really, really wrong. And there are many of them. And I think mental health is one where we demonize that, and now we're starting to shift. So I think this is exciting. Again, another reason why I'm positive and very optimistic for the world. We are starting to rethink these things, and the conversations are starting to happen at the very highest level, and I think that's amazing.
So I guess coming into the future, like the stuff that you've seen, and I guess, both of you are so immersed in this industry, what are the most interesting technological innovations that are happening around healthcare that you see in the next 10 or so years? Like, what's really piqued your interest? And is there anything that if you weren't doing Babylon or weren't doing Calm, you'd be like, I'd be doing that?
So we have four to five things are coming together that will change everything about healthcare. One is diagnostics is becoming free. We can now follow your body soon for free, the same way we follow your car. We can monitor you all the time. Two is knowledge is already freely available. You have access through the internet, through everything humanity knows about medicine, give or take. The problem is how do you analyze that knowledge and make sense of it, but the knowledge is available. Three, we now have ways of reaching people in a way we never had before. My mobile phone today, whatever it does, it's only 50% of its capability next year. It's 3% of its capability 10 years from now. Sorry, 5 years from now is 1,000th of its capability 10 years from now. What does something that is 1,000 times more powerful do? And that is assuming we stay on Moore's Law and not move to quantum computing. As you know, D-Wave just shipped the first quantum computers that could do 50 times more than the fastest supercomputer can do. And finally, everything we know in intervention in healthcare, everything, is melting into air, right? Whether it's electrobiology or synthetic biology, whether it's organ manipulation or laser intervention, whether it is DNA reconstruction, organ reconstruction. We are doing things we never thought we could do before. So I think there is no point in forecasting the future, but whether this is 50 years or 500 years, one thing is for sure, we will conquer, there's nothing for sure, but one thing is my belief, we will conquer the whole process of death and aging. We die because we age. And we age, if you look at your cancer cells in your body, they actually are the trick into, you know, eternal life, because they don't age. They replicate themselves fast and almost identically, like an old photocopy machine that used to fade. That's what our cells do, that's why we age, but cancer cells don't, right? So if we can replicate the same, and we've done it with tomatoes already, where we stopped the aging process, we could get to a place where none of us can imagine where it's going to be. So I think it's futile to predict the future of healthcare. One thing is for sure. We will make healthcare accessible, affordable, put it in the hands of every human being on earth. There is no question in my mind. That healthcare we got today, we will do. The problem is what new challenges would it put in? Mental health, I mean, it's just, I mean, the statistics on mental health is unbelievable. 15 people today in Britain have taken their lives. For every one of them, another 10 would have committed suicide and are in hospital trying now recover. 10,000 human beings in Britain, 10,000 are sitting at home with clinical depression and are not leaving their home. And you know what we do with them, Daniel? What do you think we do with you if you have a mental health issue and you're not a middle class kid? What do you think we do with you? Guess. What's your most likely outcome of what we do with you? We put you in jail. No, we put you in jail. You're right. You may end up on drugs, you may end up on alcohol, because when your mind is in pain, how do you get out of that pain? Constantly, right? You become alcoholic, you may take drugs, you may do something, but it's because you are in pain the whole time, right? So what we do, we criminalize you, we put you in jail, and then we say, oh, 70% of our jail people have mental health issues. I mean, shame on us. Shame on us. 2,000 people last night slept in County Cook Jail in Chicago alone for no other crime but having mental health issues. That's our society that we deal with, guys. That's just the reality of healthcare today.
And you actually have a feature in Babylon, which is being able to talk to a therapist as well. It's one of the actual functions, which I think is extremely meaningful, and obviously that is at the point of needing a cure, or at least some kind of interaction. Obviously mindfulness is hopefully the path to being at peace with your inner self.
Well, just to answer that question, I think healthcare is so exciting at the moment. The combination of health and technology, there's so many different areas.
Just so you know, Ali said predicting it was futile, so whatever you do, don't predict it.
I'm not going to predict it, but there's a lot of crazy, wonderful stuff going on. But to build on what Ali said, I think one of the most important areas is neuroscience. Everything starts from here. This is the frame, the window in which we see the world. We can make a heaven out of hell and a hell out of heaven. And so taking responsibility for our own lives and understanding this and learning about it is so valuable. And as I said earlier, we don't teach it at schools. We're starting to, but we need to lean into this and learn about it. So the more you know about your brain, the better, the more. And I believe it's the very plastic thing. You can reshape and rewire your brain, and there's so much science showing that you can, instead of being a slave to your mind and yanked around by your emotions, you can take control and become a master of your mind, and that changes everything. And so mindfulness and developing a practice like meditation, as simple as it seems, is so powerful. And there's many other things you can do as well. But yeah, personal responsibility, because I think it's going to take a while for governments and traditional healthcare to catch up with that.
But talking about the human positive angle, which I'm glad you both take in terms of what we'll achieve as humanity over the next 50, 60 years, one of the things that is virtually impossible to deny is, you know, the effect on people, citizens in every country affected by artificial intelligence. Even if we were just to use the example of Uber and then eventually self-driving cars, which is probably going to be the fastest revolution of them all, because I think that's probably where there's the most data and the most mapped journeys and experiences. And all those Uber drivers that have been given a purpose and a sense of income and reality, having that eventually taken away, and a lot of them aren't even familiar with the fact that that will happen. And it seems fairly inevitable. So the question is, when the journey for mindfulness and the journey for self-acceptance and the journey for finding that sort of inner peace that is at odds with what's causing people to take their lives, when you take away someone's livelihood and someone's sense of purpose of why they can get up and be productive in the world every day, how do you think that that is at odds with this positive view of society? You know, what are we going to do? Mostly, what are you going to do as the entrepreneurs at the heart of this? And obviously, Babylon is so heavily built on artificial intelligence, so I would imagine that you have a perspective there. But then, you know, anything that's affected by artificial intelligence there will hopefully be solved by Calm as well. So can you both, you know, both answer that in your own ways? Ali first, sure.
So it sounds like we're going to create the problem, you're going to solve it, right?
Absolutely not.
Look, artificial intelligence is one of these things we are unleashing again, where we have no idea what it's going to do, right? We just don't know what it's going to do. Does that mean we should not unleash it? That's just not right, right? So if you think about healthcare, all this healthcare we talk about, $10 trillion industry, only 50% of the world population have access to it. Bottom line, others don't, right? Of those who do, only 5 billion people in the world, 5 billion, have no access to surgery. Of those who do have access to some kind of healthcare, if you live in India or you live in China and you are in not in one of the main cities, 80% of the diagnoses you will receive are wrong by a doctor, right? I mean, just think about these things, right? So when we come back and say, so what is the solution? There is no budget in the world that will allow us to create the 5 million doctors we do not have, to give it to the people who can't afford it, right? The beauty of artificial intelligence is that when you fix a problem, you fix it for good,
yeah,
right? And it's there and it's in the hands of every human being who can access it. On the 27th of June, which is next week today, we're doing something really mad, which is we have a private event, but we will live stream it and you could see it, where we have Royal College of Physicians, Stanford University, and Yale University putting our artificial intelligence to test to see whether it can diagnose. By the way, if FDA is not listening, not diagnose, to advise you on the disease you may have, on the treatment you may require, right, on as well as a doctor can. Right, a practicing doctor can. Now imagine you're a mother in Kabul or in a village in countries I come from, and you now have access through that mobile phone you have, who can tell you whether what disease your child has and what's the best treatment for that. So when you see that doctor who is not up to date, you can say, well, actually, I know this is the best treatment and this is probably the disease. How wonderfully powerful is that? To stop humanity from achieving and reaching that, for what it could go wrong, is wrong. Mm. It really is, as my kids call it, the first world problem, right? Because I am so tired of having conversations with these mighty doctors who sit in Harley Street or practice in one of the richest cities in the world and say, yes, but I have this. Well, get your bum to Rwanda, where I practice, where nobody has access to you. And instead of charging £200 an hour or £150,000 of salary from the NHS or whoever else, go and deliver services at prices they can afford, and then become mighty. Artificial intelligence has a very, very big role to play to solve the existing current problems. It doesn't mean it cannot create unwanted other challenges.
So to discuss those burdens, Michael?
Well,
is it something you guys talk about or think about? I mean, you're in San Francisco. I would imagine it's not that uncommon to have this kind of conversation. So what is the general view at Calm HQ on this topic?
Fascinated by AI. My business partner in Firebox back in the late 90s, Tom Boardman, studied artificial intelligence at Birmingham in 95, 96. So been talking about it forever. It's only in the last few years that it's really kind of taken off. I'd agree with what Ali said. First of all, it is out of Pandora's box. We can't go putting it back in.
Sure.
So let's be intelligent, let's be conscious, let's think carefully about what is happening. And I think the pros far outweigh the cons. And just as a slight side from that, talking about your original question, I just want to clear something up on mindfulness and meditation. It's not about chilling out or putting on white robes and skipping through fields and thinking everything is going to be fine. I think that's the perception a lot of people have. It's about training your brain and understanding your own mind. And I think a very good analogy that helped me years ago was we go to the gym to train our muscles. We lift weights. That resistance builds up our strength. And we meditate to strengthen our mind. It wanders and we bring it back. It wanders, we bring it back. And the more you do that, the stronger your mind comes. And then in everyday life, the balance of power shifts from your lizard brain, your amygdala, where you react to everything, more to the prefrontal cortex, where you respond. And so going through life, you have the ability, fraction of a second more, to make, hopefully, what are better decisions in life. And so you can decide to retrain. You can understand complex issues. You can rethink the way someone gave you a funny look or something weird happened that might send you off into a weird negative spiral. So I think that's why it's so important. And
to quote one of my favorite authors, he was a futurist in the 50s called Alvin Toffler.
Yes, of course.
And he said, the illiterate of the 21st century won't be those who can't read and write. They'll be those who can't learn, unlearn, and relearn.
Very true.
And I think that in regards to the artificial intelligence debate, hopefully the idea is, well, how much purpose is there necessarily in stacking shelves when that can be automated? But there's a lot of purpose in training someone to do something that can advance the human race and be involved in that kind of technology revolution. So hopefully there's a lot of retraining opportunities to come.
But Daniel, let's not be idealistic about this either, right? The person who does shelves at the moment
is now their co-founder of Calm.
Yeah, but their opportunity, unless they're like you, their opportunity to retrain fast, get into a career again, and make a meaningful living out of that is not as significant as you think, right? So people all talk about, well, look at the agrarian revolution, what happened? We went from 98% of people as workers to 2%, right? And that wasn't that amazing. But the truth is that what did we see after the displacement of those societies? We saw the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution. We saw displacement of tens of millions of people, hundreds of millions of people becoming miserable through a very long period of time until the society, after a couple of centuries, settled itself. The reason people vote for Brexit, I don't know how many of you have gone to some of these mining towns in the north where there is just no hope, right? The reason Trump gets elected is because the aspirational middle classes have become desperational. They just have, it's a desperate situation, right? When your child has no other job or job opportunity than stacking shelves and for which to get minimum wage, what do you do, right? Well, you used to have a good factory to do. So I think it's sometimes easy for those of us who are incredibly fortunate. We all belong to the top 1, 2, 3, 4, 5% of the society. By the virtue that we live in London, we're almost there, right? Mm. Our poorest are almost in the top 10% of the world, right? To then make that judgment that the rest of the world is going to retrain itself, I tell you, chances of an Uber driver in India to retraining themselves just like that and become or a you know what I mean?
But then that plays into Uber, the problem.
Six or seven years ago,
they were running the, what do you call it, tuk-tuk?
Yes. I know, I agree with you. We don't want to paint too aspirational a picture, but I don't think there has ever been a better opportunity to retrain and rethink. You know, half the world's population now has access to the internet.
Yes.
That's pretty staggering.
Yeah.
And not everyone is going to be able to create a business and become self-employed or a freelancer, but a higher proportion than ever before are. And again, I think the more we can give people opportunities, the better. And more people are moving out of abject poverty than ever before. Again, back to the Factfulness book. So again, positive, but it's not going to happen overnight, obviously.
Yes.
And I guess it's to end on a prickly question, you'll be pleased to know, Ali. You know, to start with Michael, calm in itself is almost hypocritical in its existence potentially because it lives on your phone. It is an app, first and foremost, but smartphone addiction is so heavily cited with some of the psychological problems that are leading towards suicides, loneliness, etc., etc. So is that a conversation that you've had at Calm HQ about this kind of ironic situation of where Calm lives?
Yes, 100%. And what I would say to that is
fuck off.
storm off, rip my microphone off, is that, look, technology is not the problem. Mobile phones are not the problem. They are tools. It's how we use them that matters. And most of us are dopamine frazzled zombies, scrolling mindlessly and not using these devices and technology in an intelligent way. What meditation and mindfulness do is allow you to rethink how you use these devices, because they're extraordinary. We carry supercomputers with us wherever we go. We can do so much with them, but if we're not conscious about how we do it, it can make us miserable. Mm. So I would say, I think what we do is something very positive. We use this device in a very positive way, but there are many ways you can use these devices in a negative way. Look at electricity. It can be used to cook your dinner, or it can be used to execute someone in a jail through electrocution. It is neither good nor bad. It's how we use it that matters.
And Ali, just from what you've seen in the healthcare industry, do you think there's an aspect of, you know, for example, biohacking? There's a lot of conversations about how to make us, you know, better, more powerful humans, got all these superfoods and everything. And then obviously technology on top to enhance things, got the artificially intelligent human being. What do you think about those kind of thoughts and how dangerous that could be for society? Unfortunately, it's not something Babylon's working on, so it's not as awkward for you as it was for Michael.
Well, look, you and I can't talk about biohacking because we already biohacked ourselves. We're wearing glasses,
this
right?
Is true.
I mean, it's just we've done this all our lives. We try to improve as humanity. One of our things was, as Homo sapiens, we figured out how to use tools, right?
Yep.
As other sapiens did too. So I got no problem with that, right? I mean, I'm older than most of the people in this room. I'm now starting to suffer from a knee problem and a back problem and a hip this and a that. And honestly, if somebody can hack all these pains away, I'll take it any day of the week.
Okay, so if anyone's got any Nurofen on them, yeah, then that's what
I'm not one of these purists to say it needs to be my body or no body. Like I cycle, like this morning after a hour and a half of cycling, I would have given anything to have a biohacked bum that doesn't hurt as much on those.
So objectively, arguably, I believe you are in the company of two outstanding entrepreneurs, and I thoroughly encourage you to listen to each of their episodes, because the idea behind Secret Leaders is actually to humanize the stories, right? These guys have built and are building incredibly big businesses, but they're human, they're full of faults, they get it wrong along the way, they're willing to talk about it, as is every single guest on Secret Leaders, and that is the core mission, right? Is to share that it is completely achievable and everyone fails regularly, repeatedly, and you guys will both still fail many times into the future until you reach the zenith of your powers, I would imagine. So that's it from me. Thank you very much to everyone for coming down, and a massive round of applause to our guests.
A healthier brain is the key to a happier life. That's what we believe at Heights. And our mission is to make brain health simple for you, which is why we've teamed up with experts to deliver a mix of nutrients and know-how to help your brain thrive now and for the long term. If you want to keep your brain at its best, like our secret leaders, you can enjoy an exclusive 25% discount off our launch product, the all-natural, vegan, smart multivitamin, packed full of everything your brain and body needs and nothing it doesn't. Just use the code LEADERSHEIGHTS at www.yourheights.com.
Next week on Secret Leaders.
We're like, well, why don't we try to do a celebrity swag bag subscription and, you know, launch with 2,000 units in spring of 2013. Sold out of those 2,000 within 2 days. Katie and another team member did not think we were going to sell out of 2,000. So they ended up putting all the best products in the first 12 or 1,300 boxes. And we had bloggers post pictures of the box saying, this is the FabFitFun box. Then we had customers complain, well, my box doesn't look like this box.
That was co-founders Daniel Brukeem and Katie Ann Rosen Kitchens. Oh, and I thought Dan Murray Serta was a bit long. She's definitely showed me. They're the founders of the West Coast's latest billion-dollar unicorn darling, FabFitFun, the amazing subscription box service full of curated full-size products for wellness, beauty, and lifestyle that's grown to over 1 million customers and shows no signs of slowing down. They're one of the most exciting companies in America growing right now and have just launched in the UK, so be sure to tune in or you'll miss out. We hope you enjoyed this episode. It was brought to you by me, Dan Murray Serta, producer Rich Martell, editor Harry Morton of Lower Street Media, and marketing by Hannah Russell of Mags Creative, and stunning visual design by our talented designer Christina Naru of smartupvisuals.com. You can check out show notes, transcripts, and our upcoming live events on our website, secretleaders.com. If you've not yet, please hit subscribe. Leave us a review, tell a friend, take a screenshot of this episode and add it to an Insta story. I mean, you know what to do. And tag us at Secret Leaders or at Dan Murray Serta, and we'll add you to our story in appreciation back. Rich and I put together Secret Leaders for free because we love our day jobs as entrepreneurs, but every time someone takes the time to share it, it means a lot to us. So don't forget, it's the little things like that that keep us coming back every week and every year into the studio. See you next week.